Andrew Griffith, MP, has one of the most interesting jobs in government, as Minister of State for Science, Research and Innovation. His boss, Rishi Sunak, created the department, so it's fair to say that he's pretty interested in the job that Andrew is doing. Andrew had a proper business career before politics, being the Chief Financial Officer at Sky. In the time that Andrew was there, it scaled from 3 million customers to 30 million. At Sky, he worked alongside the Murdochs.
One of the most supportive bosses I've ever had.
He's also served on the board of Just Eat. We talked to him in this episode about what excites him about the future of British science and why he can't stand donuts anymore.
None of which I can eat today.
Andrew, welcome to Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. So nice to sit with you again. What's the job of Science Minister?
It's a great job. Honestly, it's one of the most interesting, but also really important to all our futures job in government. So my responsibilities are broadly to oversee, working for the Secretary of State and ultimately the Prime Minister, the funding system of research and innovation in the UK. This year, that will reach a record high of £20 billion of taxpayers' money that's designed to deliver the vision of the UK as a science and technology superpower. That's important to all of us. It's a big responsibility because it's how do we continue to make the UK prosperous? Like I always say, it's the answer to the question, you know, what do we as a nation want to be when we grow up? Right? It's a big, bold, competitive world out there. A lot of countries want to do the sort of same things that we can do. We can be that science and technology superpower. We've got four of the top 10 universities in the world with 1% of the population. We punch way above our weight in terms of the patents and Nobel Prizes and all of the other metrics of that science and research base. But of course, we want to also turn that into the jobs and companies of the future. So that's my job, you know, helping make that system work, giving reality to the science and technology framework, which is sort of modern industrial policy for science, where we set out, you know, what we want to do in AI, semiconductors, quantum engineering, biology, and future telecoms, the connectivity that's, you know, connect us all.
And what excites you most? Because I genuinely think this must be one of the best jobs in government, right? You literally get to peer into the future almost every day around what scientific discoveries are happening and so on. What really excites you in science at the moment?
I'm really excited about the developments that are happening in engineering biology, that's synthetic biology. That's creating new compounds that have never been made before, or making things, manufacturing things, but using the basic building blocks of life. So it's called engineering biology. It's one of those technologies that's, you know, reaching prime time now, partly because it feeds off technologies like artificial intelligence as an enabler. The UK, with its real strength in the life sciences, is really well equipped to do very well. We've got over 1,000 of these engineering biology companies here in the UK. And of course, for me, it's a new domain. You know, yeah. I'd come across from my own background at Sky, I'd come across some of the other technologies. But for this and seeing what's going on in engineering biology, it's a really big and exciting opportunity. The government's putting money in. We've got £2 billion. We've launched our own engineering biology vision. That is just one thing, Jimmy. I'm afraid there's a lot because, you know, there's space, there's quantum. There are a lot of, you know, what you'd call verticals. And it's, you know, as I say, it's a weighty responsibility to make these decisions, put the little touches on the tiller to try and get that right.
Are there any, you say there's 1,000 engineering biology companies. Are there any particular ones that have kind of impressed you on your travels?
Look, we've got companies based here in Cambridge on science campuses. BitBio is a really good example of that. There are companies making future sustainable fuels out of algae, out of waste. You know, the engineering biology process is essentially, you know, brewing. It's what you heard about with the RNA vaccines. It's what we've always done to make beer and foods. There's new companies that are literally making new foods and finding new ways to protect or fertilize crops. Again, just using nature's building blocks.
And you're quite unusual for a politician in terms of having had a very senior business background before, and lots of politicians will claim they were in business before, but you were literally the CFO of Sky, and you were one of the youngest FTSE directors in the country. What persuaded you to give that up, to get into politics?
That is a very good question, Jimmy. And, I'm signed on again for the next election, but ask me at the end of the decade. Look, it is, right? Government is the scale platform. So if, I'd concluded one chapter of my career, if you like, the Sky grew very, very successfully. I was there 20 years, not quite man and boy. And in that period, it scaled across different products. It scaled in terms of its value, its employee base. It ended up having 40,000 employees across 7 different markets and, 40 odd million customers that we were serving, broadband, television, all sorts of modern things too. But if you want, there's an advert if you like, if you want to apply yourself to some of the biggest challenges, whether it's, how do you protect nature? How do you continue to extend human life? How do you make the years that we've got of human life more livable through treating new disease? And how do you make sure that the country you live in continues to have a vibrant economy? Something you were very passionate about, I know, when you were in number 10 before me. And there's a bit of old-fashioned public service, so I popped out after that 20-year career at Sky. I was starting to do some non-executive roles, which I did at Just Eat, which is a food tech business. Again, really interesting. I mean, I'd still be doing that if it just hadn't serendipitously changed. But it is a bit of old-fashioned public service. Folk do that. Many of us are going to have multiple chapters or phases on our career. I was probably a bit too young and not perhaps as fit enough to be going and dedicating my life to cycling up and down Italian Dolomites, which, is what some of my contemporaries, did after a full-on business career for that period of time. You're right. There aren't that many people, I think, in this postcode that have done that. It'd be nice if there are a few more. And it's a way of, trying to put back and make a contribution to the country that we all live in.
What surprised you about the job?
The job of just being in government and parliament and things.
Sort of what I guess, what are the differences to business?
Oh, well, there's a lot. There's a lot. And not all of that was a surprise. I'd had contemporaries that had gone into parliament. All of the businesses that I'd been involved in were regulated businesses. And so that brings you into the orbit of government as well. But it is really hard. Government doesn't have the same single point metrics that you have in business. In business, you'll have a sales target, customers, EBITDA, cash flow. You've got some fairly clear metrics. Government has relatively little data when it actually makes decisions. And most of them are trade-offs. They're nearly all trade-offs. How much do you try and help, younger generations versus older generations? What's the balance between prosperity and security? So government by its nature, I think, is quite hard. It's quite siloed, like a lot of big, complex human organizations. But perhaps because of some of the things that make people tick that go into government or politics, it can be a little bit harder, I think, to get goal alignment. When you're leading an organization, trying to create shared goals and get everyone vested in the same goals, is your basic MO. It's the basic way that an organization can try and move forward. And then government, the system of government is quite risk averse. And so, why is it slow? Why is it sometimes painful? Quite a lot of the incentives in this system, not about parliament or government, it's the whole system. Quite a lot of the incentives are wrong. They are wrong for risk taking. So whether it's freedom of information, public accounts committee, having to do business cases constantly, and some of the reward mechanisms, almost drive survival bias, right? So, we're brilliant. I've worked with some brilliant people in the civil service, absolutely well-led civil servants, I think, do a fantastic job. But some of the incentives they're under are, again, quite risk-averse. Sort of if you don't screw up for long enough, as it were, you can get a decent pension, you can depart with the nation's thanks. But a lot of the job along the way can be, I'm overgeneralizing, Jimmy, but they can produce a risk aversion where people don't want to or feel that they aren't rewarded for sticking their neck out or indeed for sort of delivering big concrete things.
And one of the areas that you're kind of responsible for as a minister is getting sort of business people into government or into the sort of various arm's length bodies, etc. And you're recruiting for quite an interesting position at the moment as the chair of Innovate UK. Just explain to us what Innovate UK does and how that kind of relates to government.
Innovate UK is a fantastic, it is the innovation agency. So if you think about, you know, research and development, a lot of that is what they call discovery, sort of basic research. Takes place typically in university, in an academic context, perhaps in a very specialized laboratory. Innovation is the process of taking that out, releasing that into the wild, creating products, trying to find new markets for them. So innovation is how humankind moves forward, right? It's not just writing slides or papers. This is how you actually apply it. And the job of executive chair of Innovate UK, which we're advertising for right now, like all these government appointments, you can find them on gov.uk or just go to your search engine and type in government or public appointments, is a leadership role. So it's an executive role leading that innovation agency. You end up with a budget of about £2 billion a year to disport, and that goes to businesses predominantly, and it's businesses that are seeking to partner on innovation. So it could be a new technique, it could be a new tool, a new product, competitively driven, and it also runs what are called catapults. And catapults you may be familiar with, but again, you know, they have specialist areas. It might be advanced manufacturing, new materials, satellite applications. There's a chain of catapults. And again, as the executive chair of Innovate UK, you're responsible for that. The third and final part of that is you sit on the main executive sort of committee of UKRI, UK Research and Innovation. And so you're a big voice for innovation. You know, I was thinking, the sort of research looks after itself. That's the bit that universities have been doing since the beginning of time. Innovation is where the government would like to pivot to a little bit more. It's never at extremes, but one of the big themes about how you build a science and technology superpower, if you like, is to put a little bit more of the money and a little bit more of the focus on the innovation side of things, which again, you know, then leads to the startups, the scale-ups. And before you know it, you've got some really successful businesses based here in the UK.
How does that link to ARIA as well? Because that's another sort of relatively recent development from the government as well. And sometimes I just think it can be hard for people to kind of like put these together and how they interlock.
Yeah. And I mean, the good news is that we're doing a lot, right? Mm. I mean, the reason it's hard to keep up is actually over the period of this parliament, you know, we will have significantly increased by over a third the amount we spend on research and innovation. We've reorganized some of the funding councils so they work more closely together. More of the money is agile and flows across those. We're eliminating or reducing bureaucracy for those that have to apply for all these grants, as well as the process of delivering them. So we're trying to be a bit faster. And as you say, we are creating new institutions. So it could have been, you know, the AI Safety Institute. The one you talk about, the Advanced Research and Innovation Agency, is actually ring-fenced. It's a ring-fenced pot of money, overly colloquial, but it's more high-risk research. So it's not as closely tied to a near-term business case or a return. So the idea is operating at the sort of frontier edge of research and innovation and a different model, you know, a different model with, you know, a little bit less oversight, a little bit more creative freedom to look at those interesting areas of research that perhaps aren't fully part of the mainstream today.
And you've held a number of different jobs in government, which for being there for 4 years is quite unusual to have served in three or four different kind of major departments. What's been your favourite job?
Oh, look, I think as in all my time at in previous roles, your favourite job is always the one you're doing right there now because you're immersed in it. I was privileged to be the economic secretary to the Treasury. I think that's more commonly known as the city minister. You're responsible for the whole of the UK financial services and financial and professional services industry. Pretty good fit, right? Yeah. I was a finance director myself for 11 years. I'd raised capital. I'd started my career working in the city. And there was a really big program of reform that Prime Minister Chancellor and I were privileged to work on you know, again, you may know as the Edinburgh reforms, the Mansion House reforms, those are just sort of collective nouns for a lot of reforms to design to help capital in the UK take risk, make ourselves more internationally competitive as we've got the opportunity to get our rule book back after the EU, deliver better pension outcomes for people by, again, easing some of the regulations that meant that a big pot of UK pension capital, second biggest in the world, you know, we've got a really big asset there in how much people have saved for their private pensions, but get that working harder for future pensioners by investing earlier on and taking a little bit more risk rather than leaving it in things like the gilt market. So as you can tell, you know, there's a certain amount of passion in my voice. I was very animated, you know, with that. That was, I thought, a good fit. There was a clear sense of the mission that the Chancellor and I and others had at that time, being continued ably by my successor. And, you know, look, I moved up. I mean, I thought it was a 24-month, you know, job of work. I had, you know, an old-fashioned sort of Gantt chart on my wall about each and every one of those reforms and how you turn them from, you know, creating the idea to delivering them, sometimes legislating for them and getting them out into the wild. And so I suppose I moved about 14 months into that 24-month journey. I couldn't be happier, don't get me wrong. But certainly, you know, that was a big piece of work of my time in government.
And why do you think the sort of the London Stock Exchange and the capital markets are struggling at the moment in the UK in terms of companies leaving, etc.? And I know that's what a lot of these reforms are around, and there's lots of small things. But how do we change that? How do we make the UK a more attractive place to list?
Look, I think a few things. I mean, I can't not preface it with, look, there's generally a drought of new issuance in general. Mm. You know, we've gone from a world, the world that you and I have been in for almost the last 15, 20 years, a very low cost of capital. And now capital once again has an opportunity cost. There's a lot of geopolitical risk that people are still working to price. And as a result, the level of issuance we've seen, you know, across all markets has been quite low. And there's been a degree of consolidation. And when you see consolidation, that will often, you know, result in some companies departing from the market. So I think the problem statement a little bit is overstated and it's a little bit transient. But that is not to engage, because that was the purpose of the reforms, some of which still have to fructify. So, you know, a lot of the decisions have been taken. The remedies are on their way or already here, but we haven't yet seen all of the benefit from that. I think if you want to simplify, you've got the sort of core rule book, right? You know, do we have a set of rules that are pretty much at par with NASDAQ or whoever the pace car is for new listings or existing listings? I think we've got a long way towards that. Things like related party rules, the ability to raise fresh capital if you've already got a listing, the paperwork that you need on your prospectus. You know, I think you can say we've got clear line of sight to get that piece at par. You've got some of the culture pieces, which are a little bit harder to fix. Again, things like the Mansion House Compact, where all of the biggest pension funds in the UK have signed up, perhaps there's a bit of psychological safety in them all acting together to put a minimum of 5% of their assets under management into more risky or illiquid assets. Right. That still leaves 95. Anyone listening or viewing thinking, help, that's my pension. To be clear, that leaves 95%. You know, that's very solid and where it is. But it does offer potentially the chance for better returns. So some of those barriers are just a little bit of inertia. And I think we are starting to see changes on that. There's some government initiatives as well about creating new vehicles for them to invest in the life sciences, in deep tech. That will actually create catalysts for that money to start flowing. And then the third and final piece, which is harder to fix and harder for any individual politician or government, is culture. And, you know, I talk quite a lot about culture, a culture of, you know, rewarding risk takers, a culture of celebrating wealth creators. You know, you think about, you know, even just some of the media coverage of business. You know, if you look at the nation's biggest broadcasters, you know, often the business piece, and I know efforts have been made over the years, but often the business piece is always sort of, you know, a business that's failed or is accused of exploiting its customers or something. And we are competing against other markets. Most businesses you know, to a degree can choose where they locate these days. And if always, you know, the sense is that we're a bit negative, we're a bit down, if, you know, if CEOs and leaders create great wealth for their shareholders, their employees and their customers, you know, it's not a bad thing that we pay, you know, top people, top talent. I used to use the example of, you know, what a Premier League squad costs, right? And I mean, probably, you know, there's a lot of people who think, well, footballers, well, clearly that's a very disconnected amount of money. But we don't pay CEOs of really big complex organizations that might be developing the next cure for cancer or dementia or even just maintaining critical supply chains that give us all security of supply as a country, or even a defense company that's, you know, helping to defend the sovereignty of Ukraine right now in theaters of war. You know, we'll jib against sort of, you know, sometimes the compensation packages there. You wouldn't necessarily get the same issue
for a squad player in
Premier League football, and not many of our UK CEOs would make the squad of a football team. So I don't want people to take that to extremes. You know, it's important we contextualize that, because we're talking about a lot of money that to ordinary folk, you know, is a lot of money. But if we are serious about, you know, being a successful world-class economy and in some domains competing for world-class talent, that is a culture conversation, I think, that we also have to have as well.
And how could we change the culture? I mean, obviously that's a really difficult question to answer, but what are the types of things that we could do to improve that conversation around wealth creation?
I think having some honest conversations is the start of it. I think, you know, just recognizing that there's always an unintended, you know, consequence as well. You know, when we pass well-meaning legislation, you know, that might be in the domains of, you know, financial reporting, disclosures. You know, we have to also, as well as having an eye to the societal effects that we want here, also have to look at what's going on elsewhere in the world. It's a little bit like, you know, this government, its predecessor, has done great work on climate, net zero, was involved in some of that. You just also got to have a weather eye about you're not just exporting jobs to somewhere that's actually got a higher carbon footprint. So there are analogies as to how you think about financial markets. And clearly in this current job, as science and innovation, it's really important that we attract the best global talent and we attract the best global capital to come here as well. So excited that Flagship Pioneer last year set up their international office here in the UK. It's why Moderna's just opening factory in Oxford. It's why Andreessen Horowitz, you know, opening again their international office. These are really good. I mean, we don't celebrate these enough because, you know, people will talk about the London Stock Exchange. There's a huge amount of private capital, venture capital, and that's very much HQ'd here. And we're seeing more people come here and base themselves here.
On the job at Sky, it's interesting, actually, you mentioned sort of Premier League football there and so on. Like, Sky obviously took like quite a big bet in the 90s with football in terms of making it so much more kind of entertaining and like putting a lot of money into it. And it's done the same with cricket, etc. How did those sort of, what was it like being sort of like part of that journey of how these sports kind of evolved now into massive global brands? I mean, the Premier League is now one of our biggest exports, right?
Correct. I mean, you know, we'll often talk about, you know, the challenge of the London Stock Exchange, but actually the Premier League is almost the world's football league, and you'll travel around all over the world and people are fans of a UK football team. Look, my journey at Sky was an amazing period of time. That company exhibited a huge amount of growth. It was a privilege to work with Rupert and then James Murdoch, you know, one of the most supportive bosses I've ever had, because they would be challenging in terms of where the opportunities are. But if you identified opportunities, if you had conviction and passion, you know, they'd really back you. And if anything, they'd be sort of pushing as to, you know, could you go a bit faster, or, you know, go even bigger and better? And that was always a sort of mantra of that company. And then they created, again, the sort of psychological safety for risk-taking, right? It's really important. Mm. You know, I try and use as much of this in, you know, what I bring to this and other roles is can you make people feel you've got their back? You know, you support them. That's not to be reckless about risk, But risk is endemic in most human endeavor, and make sure people feel that they are very well supported in that. So that was really the culture. It was about culture at Sky, that you could do things that were big and bold. And there was, at that point, nothing bigger and bolder than taking some of these these sports that had never been behind a paywall, but equally were never often shown. There was no live cricket overseas. You could listen on the wireless and you could read a few days later, but there was no live broadcasting.
Yeah.
So it was additive to customers. But each time you did that, it was another big check.
Yeah.
The bit I don't miss about those many years is the big bidding processes, because if you won, you were writing a big check, and if you didn't win, you were going home.
Yeah, I can imagine. What was it like working with Rupert Murdoch?
Well, as I say, it was great. I mean, Rupert is, you know, he's one of the most curious people. You know, he stayed curious throughout his life. He's got a very good network. He's willing to take bold bets and sometimes double down. You know, Sky was a story of doubling down on a bold bet when the going got a bit difficult, and explore new markets. And, you know, I think obviously you saw the transition from, my time at Sky was the transition from an analog product to fully digital, you know, huge, and always supportive every inch of the way.
What's the job of a chief financial officer? Because actually they don't often sort of, you know, talk publicly, et cetera, about the job. I mean, I know they do to the markets and so on, but like, what does the actual job entail? Is it lots of spreadsheets?
I think it's a bit different in every organization. Yeah. I mean, Sky was a relentlessly commercial organization. And so you're part of a team, and you're trying to, I suppose, on one level, allocate capital, cash, investment. That's the scarce resource. Do you put that a little bit more into programming, marketing? Do you invest in people a bit more? Are you trying to build infrastructure? So you are constantly sort of goal seeking. You've obviously got a lot of stakeholder management and responsibility, because you are responsible for balancing the books, signing off the accounts, charting the financial success of the organization. And if you're a public company, you've got a huge amount of scrutiny from shareholders. You know, in my day, you know, every single quarter you would be reporting. So you'd be holding up to the world a scorecard of how your enterprise is performing. As ever, actually, when you get to be, in my view, a CFO, what you're really doing is leading a high-performing team. You're building, retaining a high-performing team. I am so chuffed that, you know, we're a real band of brothers and sisters at Sky. A lot of us had literally grown up together. But so many of the team that I had, you know, working for me in finance and then later in operations when I was the COO, have now gone on to be CFOs in lots of other companies and things like that, which is then a really good, it's a good validation of a leader, that you're building teams, but you're also developing people, and then they go on to success themselves.
What else incentivizes humans? Obviously, money, compensation, massive parts of it. But in your role as a leader in business, what else really matters to people?
I think actually, I mean, money up to a point is a sort of ultimately a hygiene factor. And I always used to find when you had difficulties retaining somebody, it was that you couldn't just say, here's another X million, you know, pounds more. Ultimately, it had to be, you know, a mission, a sense of mission, a sense of human worth. You know, might just be overcoming launching into a new market, or, you know, delivering a new process within the company, you know, getting the year-end close done quicker, or, you know, answering customers' phones quicker. But really framing a mission, tying that to some bigger purpose,
yep. You know,
succeeding, taking market share, delivering for customers, something people can relate to, and then feeling valued, feeling that the organization values them for what they do. You get those things wrong. My suspicion is it doesn't matter how much you pay somebody. You know, ultimately, they're going to look, particularly in this competitive world, right, where people are just one LinkedIn click away from their next job, their next mission in life. You've actually got to invest quite a lot in setting out what people's core purpose and mission is. The other thing is just keep developing them. You can invest in people. Again, it doesn't have to be sending them on an expensive course, but it can be just giving them that extra bit of responsibility or backing an idea that they've got.
Have you had kind of mentors along the way in terms of that development process and so on?
I never had a formal mentor, and you know, I'm old. So in those days, you know, even if I had, we wouldn't probably have called it a mentor. A big hero of mine is David Young, Lord David Young. Mm. He served in Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet. He was a big voice for enterprise. Anyone who's very old listening to this, we might remember the swoosh, the Department for Enterprise.
Yeah.
I'd love to bring that back. He did a lot of the privatizations. So, you know, when we were talking about what do we do with the next slug of the NatWest shares, that, you know, the Chancellor's announced that, you know, we're looking again to sell a big block of those shares. You know, it harkens the mind back to that. But much before that in business, I'd always had a little bit of a pick and mix approach to, you know, I've seen some interesting behaviors from such and such person. I try and integrate that into my work style. I'll give you one example to bring that to life. I hope you wouldn't mind me saying it, but Alan Layton, who was one of the big, you know, successful, probably 90s businessmen who turned around Asda, do you remember? Yeah. And he ended up being on Sky Board. I think he was chair of the audit committee. I worked really closely with Alan, and he taught me the importance of this metric called slips, trips and falls. So if you're running a supermarket, you know, the big thing you don't want is someone to fall over in the egg aisle because someone's dropped a box of eggs, it's broken, spilt on the floor, someone's come along, fallen over, tripped, broken their leg or whatever. And it wasn't so much, I suspect, the materiality of that metric to the whole organization and enterprise, but the fact that he as CFO or CEO or chief exec was monitoring that, I think sent a really strong signal to the whole organization. One is, you know, actually these little things, paying attention to detail matters. And secondly, if the guy or girl in the corner office cares about this ostensibly quite small metric, everybody else in the organization should do too. And that was just, I just thought that's like a pretty good example. And I learned that from him, that, you know, it's right to also have a lot of focus on the detail.
What would you change about government from your time in business? What would be the one thing you'd like to implement across government?
Look, I'd be pretty humble because government is different, and, you know, do not be that person that sort of comes into a very different domain from business and says, oh, if you just did everything like a business, it would all be wonderful. That is not right. Government is hard. It's complicated. It needs a different set of tools and people. That said, the one thing I would do actually is change some of the ways that we performance manage people, and that sounds ominous. So what I really mean by that is give people more flexibility on pay, gear it more to performance. I think there's very structured career scales in the civil service, and so one of the things that brilliant people I've worked with, have often said is, look, I'm going to have to move to get a promotion because a promotion is the only way I can get paid more.
Yeah.
So in an organization, we've got more flexibility. You can actually reward individual performance a bit more. And if you drive it in a very sort of structured scales, and we know why big organizations have those, then it becomes quite hard. You drive in and people moving from roles they like simply because they need to do that to get the next pay. And you know, crudely, I'd probably have fewer civil servants, fewer people working in the public sector, but I would pay them more. I would pay them more. So a lot of that does come down to sort of more performance, better appraisal, definitely better pay and a bit more flexibility. And I think you'd do that, you'd get, you know, you'd keep people better and you'd get better performance. And I don't want people to take sort of jeopardy from that, because I think, you know, these are organizations that are absolutely trying to do their best.
And how would you measure, you know, we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, but how do you measure performance in government in terms of individual civil servants metrics?
Well, there's actually a huge amount of energy that goes into like performance in a way by a proxy. So every single pound of spend ultimately somewhere has a business case that's been prepared, often at nauseam, gone up to the Treasury, come back again. Every department publishes an annual report. So there actually, I think, are a lot of metrics flying around, possibly too many metrics flying around. A lot of it is actually taking the time to continue because I think a lot of people listening with civil servants would say, well, we already do some of this. I think that's right, but we could do more and we could introduce more flexibility so that you've got greater ability. Often, you know, the PAMSEC, the DGs, the best people know who the best people are in their team.
Yeah.
And giving them a little bit more flexibility to do would help.
But you've had a real sort of like magpie of careers in, you know, you've done.
Thank you. Like, sounds worse than I think it is.
Yeah. Well, you've, you know, done law, finance, operations, politics, government. Like it's very varied and broad. What would your advice be for people from the business world looking at getting involved in politics? Because I do think it's one of these interesting trends is that people have, partly because of the internet, been able to make money much earlier in their careers and are thinking that they're going to have four or five different careers. What's your advice to those thinking of heading into politics?
Look, I mean, talk to people. I mean, I'm a massive advocate for this, and it doesn't have to be politics. You know, I am an elected politician, and to do that, you have to have a sort of party label and things like that. But there's also a huge amount of roles in public life. If you go, I'd say people go to the public appointments website, you can be anything from a beef eater, you know, to the chief exec of the Bank of England. I mean, actually, it's a function of government. You have to advertise all these roles. So there's a really rich diversity, some exec, some non-exec. I am, I suppose, an advocate and a proof point of a sort of second career. And some people will be on their third career. So I had a chapter in business finance. And I'm now, you know, it was then my late 40s, now my very early 50s, embarking on a second career. I believe in public service. This is a net a public service allocation of time for me. And I think that's very satisfying. I mean, I don't regret it. Mm. It's different. It's hard, you know, different sorts of people. Sometimes some, you know, especially different sort of people. But I don't regret it. It's very personally, you know, satisfying. It keeps your brain plastic. You're exposing yourself to new challenges at a time in life, as I say, when some people sort of decide to reduce their golf handicap. You are properly challenging yourself when you've still got enough energy to do so. So do it thoughtfully because it is different. It's not something you can just simply pan across, talk to someone like yourself, Jimmy. Anyone who wants to come and talk to me because I'm an advocate and I can help people on that journey. But I do think, look, if this is a really important thing to do, right? And, you know, at the end of the day, you look back, I suppose, without being too philosophical, you look back on your deathbed and think, well, what did I contribute?
Yeah.
Right? It's really important to, you know, be a father and a husband and all these other things. You know, people want a degree of financial security, but you also want to live a life well lived and make a contribution. And there's no bigger contribution, not just me, but many other people, than forms of public service. And there will be, for everybody, there'll be a university, a hospital, a scientific institute, a public body somewhere near them that could benefit from their talents. Sometimes a little bit of, you know, what's the Harry Potter sorting hat to sort of find the right sort of role for people's skills and the amount of time they want to put in and things.
Can you remember what your first job that you ever wanted to do was?
Oh, I wanted to, I mean, not quite be an astronaut, but I mean, I definitely, when I was probably 14, 16 or something, applied to be an RAF pilot. That was my first idea of a job. And my first real job, the first wage I got, was putting the jam in donuts in the local Tesco bakery. Tesco had just opened near where I started work. To help my family put me through university. Yeah. All my summers were spent making mince pies, donuts, hot cross buns, depending on the time of the season. None of which I can eat today. I've developed quite a reaction to all of those. Bit of overexposure early in life.
How are businesses thinking about the election? There's obviously been lots of sort of change in British politics, really, over the last 10 years. What are you hearing from businesses ahead of the next election?
Look, I mean, net businesses, I think, are still very positive on this government. They see our ambition to make the UK be the best place to start, grow, run a business. You know, I think they do see that there are people, myself, Prime Minister, the Chancellor, actually, in number 10, you know, who've all come from a business background or have raised capital. So there's a lot of understanding actually of what makes business tick. Now, look, businesses aren't paid, I think, to make political decisions, to be clear. They don't vote. And there's a certain amount of hedging, clearly, and there's an understandable function in democracy. I guess I would think personally, look, there's a certain amount of wishful thinking or self-delusion going on from business. I mean, we've heard that, you know, Rachel Reeves wants to change the fiscal rules. She wants to redefine, you know, actually what counts as borrowing to exclude things that she counts as investments. And I would worry about about a little bit about that in business, forget my current role, because if you start messing around with essentially the accounting rules, you create a bit of a wormhole in those definitions. So I could persuade myself, Jimmy, that my annual gym membership is, quote, investment, because it's giving me a healthier body and I could be more productive at work. But that doesn't create an asset on the country's balance sheet. So in that redefinition potentially of what counts as spending, borrowing and investment, I think there's a bit of danger. And a bit of danger in terms of employment practices. So yeah, I'm not going to get into the sort of partisan side of things, but, you know, understandably, businesses are going to look around and as I said, you know, decide against all the different factors what a different flavor of government would look like and how that might impact upon them. And I think maybe there's a little bit of wishful thinking going on. Clearly, it's my job and everyone in government to put our best foot forward to continue to deliver, because that's the you control what you can control, and we can do that.
Do you think businesses should be asking more questions of Labour and applying a bit more sort of rigour to, you know, what they might be looking to bring in?
I think, you know, in business you want to get as much certainty and confidence, and actually I think there's not much clarity there. You know, what would another government of a different flavour do on employment rights? Mm. You know, there's been a huge agenda that's made the UK be a very flexible labour market over the last, you know, three decades. I mean, what's actually going to happen on that? Because businesses, you know, want that flexibility, and one of the big challenges is how do you manage your workforce as a business? How attractive will the UK be for capital?
Yeah.
Right? It's not just showing up and having a few selfies in Manhattan. You know, actually, you know, what is going to be the fiscal situation? And how are you going to think? Most of the reforms that we made in the city, for example, most of the reforms, at the time we made them, at least, were opposed by other parties. Subsequently, some of them, you know, they've said they'll continue, but you can't tell which was the true version. Was it when they opposed them, or was it when they subsequently said they wouldn't change them? So there's a little bit of a risk there. Because again, I don't want to be overly partisan. It's our job to put our best foot forward. I think we've actually got a really good story to tell. We don't always get the space to fully tell it. But there are people who are locating in the UK. They're moving to the UK. They're seeing the UK often as their global hub. You saw the export figures recently. Mm. And if you look at the foreign direct investment, you know, this is the equivalent of people voting with their feet, right? This is global investors actually deciding when they could put money anywhere in the world, anywhere in Europe. Where actually is it that they're actually putting that money to work? UK is still getting more money in most spaces than France and Germany combined.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a good story to tell there.
Do a few quick fires. Would you rather go to space or the bottom of the ocean?
Space.
Have you tried the new Apple Vision Pro?
No.
What's your favourite sci-fi film?
2001.
What do you think the future of television is?
Podcasts.
That's a great answer. Have you flown a drone?
Yes.
How did you find it?
Good. I would fly in a drone.
Yeah. What's the best bit of the job?
The visits.
Yeah. Best visit you've been on?
Arctic Circle.
Oh, wow.
Tromso. Going and attending the Arctic Council in Tromso.
Well, amazing.
It's only one of them, but I mean.
Yeah, yeah, but that's a good one.
It's quite a good one.
What's your favourite donut?
Apple. Apple, not the jam donuts.
Apple, that's a rare one. Who would you invite to go to space with you? I'm not letting you take your family.
Jeremy Clarkson.
Andrew, thank you very much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. It's been great.
Thank you, Jeremy.